The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Referred to by best-selling author Rebecca Traister as exhilarating, good-humored, and forward-looking, Kristen Godsey's new book, Everyday Utopia, is a two-millennia examination of diverse civilizations' boldest dreams of and experiments in ideal societies. Godsey is the author of six other best-selling books, including the acclaimed Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism and Other Arguments for Economic Independence, which has been translated into 14 languages. A professor of Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, she has contributed articles to various publications, including The New Republic, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. And she was awarded a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship for her work in anthropology and culture studies. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with Arwa Makhdawi, a London-born, Philadelphia-based writer, speaker, and business consultant, and author of Strong Female Lead, a book urging us to reconsider our preconceptions about leadership, which offers a blueprint for the types of leaders we need in a time of perma-crisis. She writes a weekly column for The Guardian, covering everything from politics to pop culture. And she is also the creator of the viral website Rent a Minority, which is an Uber for diversity. That's the tagline. Yes, before you ask, it's satire. Please welcome Kristen Godsey and Arwa Makhdawi.
Great. Hi, everyone. So I think we're going to start off with a reading.
Yeah, a short little, tiny little reading, and then we'll just have a bit of a conversation and some questions. So, it's the book. And this is a section from a section called Why Martin Luther King Jr. Loved Star Trek. Although I am too young to have seen the original series while it was airing, another science fiction show has the distinction of being the longest lasting and most influential utopian vision that ever entered popular culture. When Star Trek began broadcasting in 1966, its creator, Gene Roddenberry, crafted a positive view of the future where humanity had overcome all of its conflicts and lived in a sort of galactic Pax Romana within something called the United Federation of Planets, an interstellar union of different worlds and species with shared principles of universal liberty, rights, and equality. In a 2011 interview, the late actress Nichelle Nichols, who played the African communications officer Uhura on the original series, recounted a story of her first meeting with the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. at a banquet. King told Nichols that he was a huge fan of the show and that it was the only thing that he and his wife allowed their children to stay up late to watch. At the time, Nichols intended to leave the show to pursue a career in theater, but King insisted that she had to stay. Nichols recalled, quote, "He said I had the first non-stereotypical role. I had a role with honor, dignity, and intelligence. He said, you simply cannot abdicate. This is an important role. This is why we are marching. We never thought we'd see this on TV," unquote. For the first generation of Black Trekkies, Nichols' portrayal of an officer on the bridge of the interracial starship Enterprise helped them envision the possibility of equality. "When I was a little girl," explained the actress Whoopi Goldberg in 2015, "it was like, oh, we are in the future. Uhura did that for me." "Imagination is more important than knowledge," said Albert Einstein in 1931. "For knowledge is limited, whereas imagination embraces the entire world, stimulating progress, giving birth to evolution." We stand on the cusp of a new age, with many of us striving toward a more positive vision of the future, like the one Roddenberry once provided, where human beings find a way to build a better world for subsequent generations of humanity. Our old ideas about patrilineality and patrilocality are no longer fit for that purpose. We need new ideas, new dreams, and the courage to imagine alternative futures. Now is the moment to think different. If we can imagine them first in a galaxy far, far away, it's only a matter of time before we boldly go and begin figuring out how to translate these inspired visions into our own everyday utopias.
Thank you so much. I really love the quote that imagination is more important than knowledge. And it sort of feels in politics, in the world today, there is sort of a lack of imagination. And if you do, you know, try to envision a better world, it's almost considered childish. You write about, you write in your book about there's a sort of a resistance to utopia. The word utopia in itself is often used in a pejorative sense and sort of seen as childish and unrealistic. How do we kind of break that barrier and get, you know, value imagination more?
Right. And, you know, I think that one of the things that's really important is that in the corporate world, for instance, or even in academia, there's this idea called blue sky thinking, mm-hmm. right? It's a term that's bandied about. And what it really means is thinking outside of the box to solve complicated intellectual or political or, you know, marketing problems sometimes, right? So the Think Different that I referred to is this iconic campaign by Steve Jobs and Apple Computers in the 90s. You know, that sort of celebrated the round holes and, you know, the square pegs and the round mm-hmm. holes and things like that. So one of the things that I think is really interesting is that in our understanding of blue sky thinking as this really important tool to get us through complicated scientific issues, the minute we apply that to the social realm or the political realm, people get uncomfortable. And I think that the reason that people are uncomfortable is precisely because there's this unfortunate equation between the word utopian and unthinkable mm-hmm. Or unrealizable, right? So this pejorative sense in which the word is used. But as with so many words, I think there has to be a kind of reclamation project, right? Which is that utopianism or utopia as a word is it's a lodestar. It's a place that you are looking towards. It's not necessarily a place that you want to go, right? Oscar Wilde said a map that doesn't include utopia is not worth glancing at, right? It's a horizon. And we need that kind of utopian thinking because we can talk about the ways in which previous social projects have actually sometimes emerged out of this utopian thinking. It's an incredibly generative place. It's a creative place. And we are at a moment politically and socially where we need new ideas. We really need to push ourselves. And historically, as I talk about in the book, it's at these moments of upheaval where you get these utopian thinkers suddenly appearing who mm-hmm. are really trying to push society forward, even if the place that they're imagining is far further beyond where anybody is really seriously thinking of going. The fact that they exist out there pulls society in a way towards these further poles than it otherwise might go.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you mention Apple and Think Different, because obviously in the tech world there is this big push for sort of utopian thinking. But it's interesting because I feel like sometimes they use that as a way to stop utopian thinking. So, for example, you mentioned geoengineering in your book, and there's a big push among some people in the tech world. Bill Gates is a big proponent of this, of like, nobody changed their behavior now. You know, he loves flying around in private jets and, like, you know, has a million mansions. Nobody changed their behavior now because we're going to invent all this crazy stuff that's going to just solve all the problems. You know, we're going to put all of our money in and we'll into geoengineering projects and we'll get this silver bullet. So we don't need to do anything about climate crisis now because in the future we'll solve it. You know, we don't know how exactly, but we'll solve it. So I feel like there is this kind of interesting tension that utopianism can almost be weaponized to stop people kind of thinking about political solutions and social changes now.
Right. So I would say that there's a real distinction between sort of what we call like techno-futurism mm-hmm. and utopianism, right? And I use the word utopian in the sense of Karl Mannheim, who was a German philosopher who really thought about utopian ideas as the juxtaposition to what he calls ideology. And so ideology in a Mannheimian sense is this idea that the sort of structures of the way things are, there's like this rigidified structure that we're in. And any challenge to that, particularly in the political realm or the economic realm, it immediately gets labeled utopian. Like, mm-hmm. we could never do that because it's utopian. So what's happening with people like, I think, Bill Gates, and it's not just with geoengineering, it's also with people who are trying to move to electric vehicles versus more public transportation, for instance, which would actually be better for the environment. So there's a way in which the limits of our imagination are always stuck within the frame of the ideology of capitalism, patriarchal mm-hmm. capitalism, as it sort of exists right now. And what I'm trying to point out in the book is that there's this whole other area, which it is very much frowned upon because people think of it as being dangerous. People fall into this idea of status quo bias, right? That it's much easier to face a bad outcome that resulted from our inaction than to face a bad outcome that resulted from a decision that we made. And so that status quo bias keeps us very much within a certain sort of set of political and economic parameters that actually makes it very difficult to see political solutions to some of the problems, right? Mm-hmm. So I like to say that there's another 1%. There's the 1%, that's the economic 1%. But in all historical epochs and in almost all cultural contexts that I looked at in the book, there's always this sliver of the population that is living completely outside of the ideology that Mannheim talks about as the kind of mainstream way of viewing the world. And it's that 1%, sometimes it grows, right? But it's always there. And when there are ruptures in society, massive sort of political or scientific upheavals, it's the utopians who end up providing the inspiration mm-hmm. in this really important way. And what happens, I think, lately, especially because of the history of the 20th century, when we have this kind of constant refrain of all these utopian visions that turned very dystopian, is that people are afraid to dream. So we end up getting stuck with what we have because there's a fear that if we make a decision, and if it goes bad, then the regret that we feel will be much more profound than if things go bad and we didn't do anything at all. So I think that there's a sort of an ingrained resistance to that, and that is why people like Karl Mannheim and Ernst Bloch, who's another theorist of hope, talk about hope and militant optimism as ways of pushing us out of these ideological boxes that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the other 1%, and your book is full of all these small-scale everyday utopias. I love the juxtaposition of everyday and utopias. And so I guess, like, when we think utopia, we think a big, grand project, but I think a big argument in your book is that small little changes can add up to utopias. And in all of the examples you have of different co-living communities, there's some really... I actually ended up putting myself on a waiting list for a commune in Maine. I didn't tell my wife, but one that I read about in your book. And there's lots of really inspiring experiments going on. Do you have a favorite one that inspired you?
Yeah, so there are so many, and they're different. Many of them are, you know, I expanded the definition here because I was looking at not only secular communities, but also looking at religious communities or communities of faith. But the one that I think really inspired me, they're all really interesting for their own reasons. There's a matriarchal eco-village, Nashira, in Colombia. There is this incredible sort of post-civilizational eco-village in southern Portugal called Tamara. There's Twin Oaks. There's in rural Virginia. There's Two Echo in Maine. But the one that really, I don't know, that really moved me was a place called Campus Gauli in southern Germany. And it is a group of experimental archaeologists who have organized to build the Plan of St. Gall, which is a 9th century outline for a Benedictine monastery in the middle of nowhere, using the materials and the tools of that time. So they don't have nails, they have wooden dowels, they don't have glass, they have translucent leather for windows. And this is a group of people who know that they will never see the completion of this project in their lifetime. And yet every day they turn up and they work to build this plan as a community, you know, as an interesting experiment in what it would be like to live in this you know, idealized, perfect Benedictine cloister. And somehow it's just like the passion and the optimism that infused that community was something really inspiring to me, because it just seemed like some of these people were professionals with real with real jobs, you know, who left their lives behind to just sort of go and build this, you know, imaginary monastery in the middle of nowhere using the tools of the 10th century, which I think is pretty remarkable.
Yeah. How much of it is done?
Quite a bit of it is done. They've been working on it now for about a decade. So, yeah. But it's, you can go visit. So if you ever happen to be in that part of Germany, it's a really interesting place to go. But some of these experiments that I talk about in the book lasted for 100 years or 50 years. Some of them are ongoing. So when we think of these communities, we think of them as very small and marginal, and often the ones that we hear about are the ones that have failed. But the ones that continue to thrive, or that thrived for a long time, we don't hear about them very often. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I didn't know before I read your book was that Pythagoras, of triangle fame, it was actually a pretty woke guy. He was a proto-feminist.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had this idea for a community about, you know, collective property and also gender equality. And that those themes, you know, of a better world, you know, needing, requiring gender equality is a big theme in your book. We can't really change the public sphere without changing the private sphere. Can you kind of talk about the intersection of public and private?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting, something that you mentioned earlier about these sort of neo-utopian or futuristic books. So, you know, people like Rutger Bregman talking about the 15-hour work week or open borders, Stephen Diamantis talking about abundance, or Aaron Bastani talking about fully automated luxury communism, right? There are all these very future-oriented books that look at like asteroid mining and universal solar power. And one of the things that they kind of leave intact is the private sphere. They don't want to touch it, the family, the way, where we live, how we live, and how we raise our children. And one of the things that I think that every single one of these utopian communities, without exception, has dealt with is this question of how we live our personal lives, how we share our lives with the people that we love and that we share resources with. And that, to me, was a real eye-opener to realize that Pythagoras and Plato and early Buddhist Cenobitic monks and Jewish Essenes, that there were communities completely disparate who all kind of come to the same conclusions about the ideal way to live in society. And it's about how we live together, with whom we live, with whom we raise our children, or if we raise our children at all. So one of the communities, many of the communities in the book that I speak about are celibate. They're cloistered monastics, or the Beguines are lay nuns, so they're not cloistered, but they're a big group of women who live together. But they raise children in common because they take in orphans or they take in otherwise unwanted children, like the Shakers. And so all of these communities, for different reasons, that they all kind of settle on a very similar set of prescriptions, whether they're Hindus, Jains, Buddhists, anarchists, socialists, environmentalists, feminists, when you actually start to strip down the doctrine or the kind of recommendations that they have, they don't want to change the world. Mm. They want to change their communities, and they do it in this really powerful way, and they persist. Throughout time and across cultures, you always have this like 1% that's out there doing things completely differently. And sometimes they fall afoul of the mainstream, particularly on the issue of gender equality. Mm. Yeah. So that's, I mean, from Pythagoras on down, making women equal has also been a big part of some of these communities, again, for different reasons, for sort of different justifications, but at the end of the day, that can often get them in a lot of trouble with mainstream society.
It feels like we have a 1% that's trying to build their own utopia that for other people is a dystopia with gender equality in this country.
Yeah.
You sort of talk in your book about the power of radical hope, and it can be hard to, you know, at this current time, feel hope and optimism. How do you kind of encourage people to channel that power of radical hope?
Right. So, you know, one of the things that I do in the book, and this is like one of those weird pandemic rabbit holes that I went down for very personal reasons that ended up kind of emerging at the end of the book because I felt like I really needed it. And I started reading, after kind of digging into Bloch and Mannheim, I was starting to read a group of psychologists who talk about hope as a cognitive capacity. So if you think about memory, memory is a cognitive capacity, right? You can strengthen your memory. If you always keep phone numbers on your speed dial on your phone and you don't remember phone numbers, like that part of your memory like atrophies. If you always put your grocery list, you know, write it down rather than trying to remember it, you're weakening, you're atrophying your memory. So people do memory exercises, like memory strength training, right? Like you try to remember things. So hope is to the future what memory is to the past for psychologists. Hope is a cognitive capacity. It's also an emotion. We generally tend to think of hope as an emotion. So the opposite of fear and anxiety is hope. It's not optimism, right? Optimism is a particular sort of belief that everything will work out. Hope, from a psychological point of view, is the cognitive capacity to imagine a future state that you want to get to and then figure out the intermediate steps that you need to get there. And also recognize that there are going to be a whole bunch of obstacles in the way and that some of the things are not in your control. So it's about figuring out what part of this is in your control, what part of it isn't in your control, and then actually doing the mental steps necessary to get there. This can be done individually, but it can also be done collectively. And I think one of the things that we as a society today suffer from is the atrophying of our cognitive capacity to hope, because we are constantly bombarded by negative news. We're constantly bombarded by dystopian visions of the future. There's AI, there's automation, there's war, there's pandemics, right? There's inequality. There's so many negative things going on in the world that we start to feel incapable. This comes back to the utopianism, right? Incapable of that cognitive capacity of hoping about the future because we're just so afraid to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, one of the things that is so essential about hope as a cognitive capacity, or what Mannheim and Bloch will talk about as militant optimism, is that it is brave, right? It's a form of political activism to say, no, the future is not going to be bad. I am going to be a part of something that makes it better. And that's where I feel like we've lost the kind of mojo to do that. And for me, reading about all these utopian communities is an exercise in saying, wow, look at all the people out there who are just moving forward into the future on their own. They're doing it. They're trying. Some of them are failing. Some of them are stumbling. But they're still trying to do something. And to me, that's really inspiring. And it gives me the ability to imagine collectively with others the ability, the possibility that the future could be actually better and that we have a role in making it better. That's the whole point of this, the agency of hope, not just the emotion of optimism, but the agency of hope. And that's something that I feel like we need more of.
Mm-hmm. Well, you wrote this book at the beginning of the pandemic, and, you know, as you write about, people imagine utopias in times of upheaval. And I, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, maybe I thought that maybe we would emerge out of the pandemic and the world would be a better place, and that, you know, people would value essential workers more, and that we would change things about society. You know, Aaron Hunty Roy wrote a lovely essay in the Financial Times similar to this. It's called, you know, it's talking about the pandemic as a portal, and we have the ability to merge into a better world. And yet, you know, now, 3 years later, it feels like actually things have got worse in many ways, like inequalities increased. How did you think the pandemic would change the world? And have you seen some positives? What's your sort of report card on?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the world, I think that we're still in a very plastic moment, right? So think about the ways in which employers are desperately trying to get people to go back to the office, right? There's this feeling of like, you know, people are saying, I don't want to go back to the office. I don't want to commute an hour in each direction. I don't want to live that way. I don't care about the things that you want me to care about, right? So the whole idea of quiet quitting, for instance, or the whole idea of the great resignation or whatever they want to be, you know, there are all these names that get bandied about. But I do think that we are still in a plastic moment. We can't see it because we're in it right now. But it's there's lots of things that are changing. It's just that it's like, that's why this concept of the sort of ideological superstructure that Mannheim talks about, right, that it's hard for us to see beyond it. You know, so what he says about utopia is that there were anything that's different from what they want us to do, they being the people who benefit from this particular ideological structure, is going to be not only hard for us to see, but it's going to be almost impossible for us to imagine, right? So it's not just about like changing things, because, you know, I think if you've heard of this concept of the Overton window, right? The idea of expanding the possibility, the political realm of possibilities. One of the things that utopianism does that is productive, and always, by the way, has been productive, right? Again, going all the way back to people like Pythagoras, who said, you know, these Greeks, I don't like the way that they're doing things. I want to go study mathematics and the mysteries of the universe, you know, by myself in Sicily with a bunch of my followers. And we're going to set up a society that's completely different so that we can do the things that we want to do. And that vision of living, right, was really shocking to people at that particular moment in history. And yet it reverberated. People were like, huh, maybe they had some ideas that are worth thinking about. I mean, Plato's Republic is very clearly a reflection on what he knew of the Pythagoreans, right, and the Spartans. So I do think that I would not be surprised if in 5 years the world is much different than it feels like it is right now. I do think we're in a dystopian moment. Mark Fisher talks about this idea of capitalist realism, right? There is no alternative. All we can see is the reality of the way that the world works right now. But I think that the pandemic shook things up in some really profound ways that people are still trying. They're like trying to claw us back to 2020, to like March 2020, right? And in some ways, things have reverted. Like, it feels like they snapped back, but then other things haven't really snapped back. And I think that it's in that weird interstitial space between how I remember things being in March 2020 and how they're trying to recreate the world of March 2020, that the realm of possibility for change exists.
Yeah, there's a lot of people trying to get people back to the office. Elon Musk being one of them.
Exactly.
Basically, anyone with an interest in commercial real estate.
Anybody or thriving real estate markets, or, you know, the whole idea that, like, I mean, you know, the traditional relationship between bosses and employees. Like, why do people want people back to the office? Because bosses need to boss, right? Bosses, you got to boss, right? And if you don't have people to boss, then what kind of boss are you, right? You can't boss on Zoom. It's hard to boss on Zoom, right? So for all these people who are bosses and who need to boss and who justify themselves and their salaries as bosses, of course they want that world to come back. But like in that moment of employees going, you know, I could do my job independently at home. I get my work done. Why do I need to go into the office? Why do I need to be bossed? Right? The whole structure of boss is under threat. And I think that's also happening with, you know, the kind of the broader concept of like head of household, right? What does that mean anymore? Right? There was a great article the other day in the New York Times about momunes, right? A bunch of single women who are getting together and who are raising their children in common because they're divorced or, you know, one reason or the other, they don't have partners. And they like, well, we don't have to have partners. We can do this together in a collective way. In Kansas, in one of the neighborhoods of Kansas City, they are banning co-housing, right? Precisely because people who own real estate are really uncomfortable with the idea of multifamily tenants in houses that are meant to be single family. And yet we have a housing crisis. So what are people doing? People are very creatively saying, well, here's a single family house. Let's divide it up and put like three families in it. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, people are going to try to prevent that from happening. But the fact is that it's happening, right? So that's where I think that people are, look, human beings are creative. They're problem solvers. And yeah, there's going to be pushback, but we can, but like in the ways of resisting, and it's not always going out on the street with a big sign, although that's important, but there are these other ways of resisting that I think are also really profound and can add up to a lot mm-hmm. of change in the end.
Brilliant. I'll just ask you one more thing before we move to questions. But, you know, this idea of human creativity being powerful and we need to be able to imagine these new worlds, it feels like we're at a moment where human creativity is kind of under fire. You know, nobody wants to pay the writers in Hollywood. You look at AI, people saying AI is going to take all the writers' jobs. I mean, Now journalism is basically just like a gig industry, Uber for content, basically. You know, I honestly, sometimes I feel like I'm going into the content mines every morning to come up with my column. But it feels like, you know, the human creativity isn't being valued these days. And like, how do we push to get human creativity valued again? And how do we kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important question. And there's a two-pronged answer to that, I think. So the first one is valuing creativity in a market way so that people can actually live and eat and pay their rent, mm-hmm. right? And that, you know, in some ways, those are the kinds of things that traditional states need to do, regulating, for instance, AI unions. There are social ways that we can organize to try to get, like, strikes, like the writers are on strike, right? There's a way in which, as long as we are thinking of creativity as something that needs to have value, and it should have value in a market, then there are going to be solutions to deal with the market, right? And the market's devaluing of it, basically. Like you said, the Uber for content problem. And this is happening everywhere, and it's going to continue happening, right? But see, here's the thing where I say the creativity. Why are these algorithms privately owned? I am sorry, but ChatGPT was trained on Wikipedia, and Wikipedia is a crowdsourced resource that was done by volunteers all over the world in multiple mm-hmm. languages. ChatGPT should be internationalized. It should be the common heritage. Nobody should make a dime. Like, if you don't, why regulate it when all you have to do is make it so that it's just by definition unprofitable? And then, like, suddenly all these people in Silicon Valley will be less interested in, you know, ChatGPT. But I think that so that's where the solution is. Like, the algorithms, they, you know, people have talked about this, right? They should be collectively owned. They should be, you know, people who are losing their jobs, who have a stake in losing their livelihoods because of these, they should not be the proprietary thing that allows these billionaires to create this inequality, and you know, so they can get in their rockets and go off to Mars. You talk about in your book, what did you call it? Big rocket energy. I just loved that. BRE. That was great. There are these billionaires with a BRE, right? But beyond that, there's also one of the things that I talk about in the book that I really think is important is the creativity in our daily lives with each other, right? It is such a pleasure to be creative, whether it's artistically or verbally or musically or, you know, in all the different ways that human beings can be creative. There are these wonderful maker spaces, right, where people are just, you know, creative for no reason, like no market reason. And I think that that's the other thing that we need to do is not only make sure that the creative industries can survive, but also to expand the definition of creativity so that we are all part of mm-hmm. creativeness, the human creativity. And that doesn't just mean in some kind of like creating a product, but also in our relations with each other. And I talk a lot about different creative ways of forming families and forming friendships and forming communities. And I think all of that needs to be unleashed. And that once you unleash that, then society really does change, mm-hmm. right? Because so many utopian visions, I think the ones that we're the most suspicious of are the ones that have been imposed from the top down. Mm-hmm. And what I'm talking about in the book and why I think it's so important to keep these utopian visions on our horizon are always the ones that come from the bottom up, mm-hmm. the ones that sort of spread organically, where people reach other people and they stand together and they hope, you know, out loud every day in a community to make the world a better place.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And on that note, love to hear from people in the audience. Anyone have a question, please raise your hand and the microphone will come.
Thank you for your conversation. It was really fun listening to you guys chatting, and I'm looking forward to reading your book. I have lots of questions, but I'll just reduce it down to two. The first one is, are you inspired at all by the vision of human history put forward by Weingrau and Graeber in their book, A New Dawn of Humanity? Because it seems to have a lot of common direction with some of the things you're talking about. And then the second one is, I would imagine that as a student of Russian history, you've heard of Arthur Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. Rosenberg wrote a book, I think, in the 20s, or I can't remember the title of it, but in it he's talking about the history of the socialist movement, and he quotes this letter by Engels in which Engels kind of makes fun of utopian socialists and says, you know, here are these people who think that by making lots and lots of very small changes, they're going to be able to actually change the structure of global capitalism, haha. I know what happens in the Russian Revolution later on, as as do you. The idea of a total project of social transformation runs into some severe problems, not just in the Russian revolutions, but in others. But it's hard to dismiss that objection entirely, I find. And I wonder how you think about that. It's true that people are resisting bosses, for instance, and that maybe Zoom and the Great Resignation have something to do with that. But at the same time, I hesitate to assent to your claim that bossing is withering away.
They certainly don't want it to wither away. No, this is a great opportunity for me to sort of explain something a little bit, I think, more detailed than it, especially because you mentioned Engels and his book, Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific. So absolutely, David Weingrau and David Graeber, The Dawn of Everything, is a book that was very much on my mind. In fact, I have the same agent as David Graeber did. So it was very much a part of my thinking about why it's so important to go back and really think about this adaptive flexibility of humankind, right? So the thing that I focus on the most in the book is, I focus on the private sphere, as Arwa said. So I'm looking at the way we live, like physically, the architecture within which we live. I'm looking at schools, the way we raise our children, and the way we manage our resources in common or privately, and the way that we form our families. And one of the things that Engels does, despite the fact that he makes ruthless fun of the utopians, is in The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State, he really does put forward an argument that pulls on many early utopian theories of the family that says if you fundamentally disrupt the unit in society which is primarily responsible for the intergenerational transfer of wealth and privilege, which is the nuclear family, in its current instantiation, you actually disrupt the entire society. This is this bottom-up model. So the problem with the Russian Revolution and revolutions that have decided to go top-down, and Kollontai, who was a Bolshevik in the Soviet Union, was very aware of this and tried to point this out to her comrades who completely ignored her, which is that they tried to abolish private property by administrative decree, tried to change the structure of society, but they ultimately left the family intact. After a revolutionary moment in the 20s, everything got reversed of these very early liberal policies. And so as long as you left the fundamental unit of society that allows for this intergenerational transfer of wealth and privilege, it's very, very difficult to actually disrupt society. So if you go back to Hobbes' Leviathan and you look at the argument for why we need a sovereign in Leviathan, it has to do with, you know, that life would be nasty, brutish, and short. We live in this very chaotic world, and so we need to have the boss, the big boss being the sovereign, right? But what's interesting about Leviathan, a lot of people don't realize, is that when you actually dig into that text, the way that people get trained to respect the sovereign is in the family, by learning to respect the father. So if you disrupt the father figure, if you disrupt the paterfamilias, you know, patria potestas is the particular framework of fatherhood that he was looking at, where fathers had the right of life and death over their own children. If you disrupt that, then you start to disrupt all of these larger structures in society. So many, many people have said that, including Kollontai in the Soviet Union in the 20s, and then she was ignored, right? Because that was like too difficult to disrupt the family. So there's this way in which I do think that as we get more creative in our family forms, and I mean this in a very expansive way, so both consanguineous and non-consanguineous kin, what is sometimes called chosen family, right? These wider networks of lateral support and care, just that move within our private lives begins to disrupt the role of the boss, the same way it disrupts the role of the head of household, and also disrupts the role of the sovereign or the political leaders, which brings us back to Graeber and Wengrow, right? Where there's this wonderful question that they pose. Humankind, if you look at the archaeological and the anthropological and the evolutionary biological record, is incredibly flexible and creative in terms of our family forms, in terms of our political forms. So how is it that we got stuck with this particular version of the market and the state and the family? And what they're doing in that book, I think, is very much a kind of adjacent project to what I'm doing, except for that I'm focusing much more on the private sphere, and they were focusing much more on the public sphere.
That was a lot of ground. Well done.
Thanks. I'm really excited about this focus on the private sphere, and it makes me think about the power of prefigurative politics and living the future that you want it to be. And that's something that I like personally really believe in, but it also feels like it's like jargon or like easy to dismiss or things like that. And so I'm wondering if, like you're saying with these examples where people like unleashed that power, like, did you see anything that helped people like embrace that approach and not just kind of, you know, wither away, even when there's so much evidence about how beneficial it can be?
Right. So prefigurative politics is perfect. It does sound really jargony, but it is a great way of thinking about acting as if you're already in the world that you want to live in. So this is why I'm such a big Star Trek nerd, right? Because what's so great about Star Trek is that Star Trek is just like, yeah, no, okay, so it's 1966 and we've got segregation and we've got the Cold War and, you know, women aren't allowed to go to Harvard, but we're just going to put like a Russian and an American and a black person and women all together on the bridge and they're all going to be officers. And we're just going to pretend like this is the future. It's just done. We're not going to talk about how we got there. It's there. So it was a way of sort of prefiguring politics in a kind of popular culture way. But in a very personal way, there's a great example that David Graeber gives in Direct Action, where he talks about, I think it was either a Sydney or a Melbourne bus driver strike. And what, rather than going on strike, what the bus drivers did was that they just didn't collect fares. So they decided to operate in a world in which public transportation was free. That was their protest, right? So if you're not going to pay us well, we're just not going to accept fares, right? So I think that prefigurative politics, it's not always easy, right? Because not everybody fully understands what you're doing, and you have to be very articulate about what you're doing and why you're doing it. And that can feel kind of tedious. Unfortunately, a lot of people, you know, I will say this from experience, on the left can be kind of a bummer. They're, right? I'm sure you've experienced these very serious people, right? Who, you know, if you, God forbid, you take a straw, and it's like the end of the world, right? So when we engage in these kind of prefigurative politics, we have to be non-judgmental, and we have to be joyous and sharing and willing to be like, hey, I'm doing this really crazy thing in my life. You want to hear about how weird it is and like what the strange reactions I get? Like, not judgy or preachy or, you know, overbearing. I mean, it can be overbearing sometimes. Like, I get it. Like, it's, you want people to understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. But on the other hand, sometimes, you know, just being happy is radical. Mm-hmm. Just being in a damn good mood. And being like, you know what? I know the world sucks, but here I did something to help somebody today, or I was part of a community, or I participated in a mutual aid network, or I, you know, I reached out and, you know, did something that made a difference, even if it's a really, really small thing. It's that kind of incrementalism. Within anarchist theory, they call it contaminationism, right? There's a kind of contaminationism. There's an infectiousness about politics that are positive. Sometimes it's referred to as joyful militancy. And I love that framing of it because too often, because we are so beleaguered by the current state of the world and we are awash in dystopian visions of the future. I mean, you mentioned Black Mirror. Black Mirror is a horrifying, if anybody's not, it's a horrifying vision of the future. Every time I watch that show, I'm like, oh my God, this feels so real, you know? But, you know, like, sometimes just, like, go and put your phone away. Spend a whole day phoneless. Like, that's pretty radical these days, right? Because the first thing you leave your phone, like, where's my phone? Where's my phone, right? So I do think there's a way in which we have to embrace the creativity, but also the discomfort of it, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that sometimes people are going to say you're naive. People are going to say that you're, you know, like you're utopian, you're pie in the sky, you're a nerd or you're clueless or whatever, irrelevant. Yeah, irrelevant is a big one. But persevere anyway, right? I think that's, and there's, you know, just to say one thing, there are these begging nuns that I talk about. They were around in like the 12th and 13th century in northern Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands. And they resisted medieval mores around women's behavior. And there was so much, they were castigated, they were excommunicated by the Catholic Church. You know, they faced a lot of approbation for the way that they were living in the world. And there are two medieval sort of mystical Beguine nuns who left us writings. And, you know, and one of them, Haidowitch, she has this beautiful letter to her young, like, Beguine novices where she says, they're going to make fun of you. They're going to be mean. The trolls are going to come. The haters. I mean, this is like the medieval, you know, version of the haters are going to hate. But your job is to persevere anyway. That's what it means to be one of us, is to just go ahead and put up with it. And I, you know, and the fact that that was written in like, you know, 1120 or something like that, it's still so relevant to the present day.
Thank you for the amazing talk. And I think your book does an amazing job to inspire people to reimagine our private lives and our private spheres. My question will be a bit depressing. So, and I think we all agree that people imagine the different constellations or different organizations that would make our lives better quite drastically. And I think Weiss recently covered how now conservative communities in Florida and Texas take their kids out of public school system to prevent them from reading Vogue books or, God forbid, learning about critical race theory. So these people are kind of also reimagining what would education or how to educate their kids could look like. So my question would be, how would you think we should approach these imaginations or people reimagining certain structures that could be perceived as doing maybe more harm in like utilitarian or not utilitarian but public sense, and how we should deal with those kind of imaginations? Or could we just take them as more, it's still better to reimagine and kind of shake up the system rather than just sit in the system and do nothing, as you mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, this is the bad apples problem, right? Which is, what do you do with the people who are going to take advantage, right, of a certain circumstance? Like, what if it's not paradise? What if it's hell, right? And this is a real fear. This is why I think we have status quo bias to begin with, is that people are afraid of this devolution into a much worse set of circumstances. But again, to come back to the earlier question about prefigurative politics, I do think that if you're constantly worried about the bad apples, you know, we as an organism, there's this fight or flight response, cortisol levels, right? If we're running away from a saber-toothed tiger, we need them. But we know that if we stay in this high level of stress, that it ends up eroding our bodies in this really damaging and irreversible way. I think that as a society, we are in constant fight or flight mode because we're constantly looking at these horrible, potential, negative people out there who are doing things that we find really, really distasteful. And they suck up so much of our attention that we're constantly on edge. And that creates a problem for us because then we're just always being reactionary and we're not reacting and we're not actually being generative and creative in our own ways. So part of this is about, you know, okay, again, haters gonna hate, right? Not to give them a free pass entirely, there are ways that we can mobilize and use certain structures of power to resist. But on the other hand, we also have to think about our communities and our ideas and our generativity, right? And I think, you know, there's a new colleague of ours who's going to be coming to Penn either next year or the year after, a woman named Malika Sarma, who is a biological anthropologist. And I went to a talk of hers, which I was the most fascinated by, because she is looking at what she calls biology at the extremes. So how are human beings going to survive on Mars? How are we going to survive in a climate crisis where the temperatures are raising, you know, beyond human comfort zones? How do people survive in high altitudes? How do people survive in, like, the central Congo where you have high pathogenic loads? And she actually does biological, you know, research where she goes in and she takes saliva samples and she checks adrenal levels and she looks at the way the endocrine system is working. And here's the beautiful thing about her research, is that we have this imagination of rugged individualism, but it turns out that from a biological point of view, our bodies are under an incredible amount of stress. We make poor decisions and we use more calories when we are alone than when we're in a community. So the only way that we are going to survive in any sort of extreme circumstances is by being with other people. Right? So as long as we're building communities and maintaining and nurturing our lateral relationships, and again, as I say, these can be kin and non-kin, we are preparing ourselves for the future, no matter what those people in the bunkers under, you know, the silos are doing. There are ways that we can think of living prefiguratively for the future that's coming towards us, right? So Elon Musk and his, you know, indentured slaves can go to Mars. And the rest of us may, you know, may not have a great planet, but we'll be, like, living happily in our communities to the extent that we can, right? I mean, you know, what are we, you know, rather than just, you know, obsess about the doom of this, mm-hmm. This is, by the way, what the Tamarins are doing in southern Portugal. These people are, like, I call them in the book extreme green preppers. They do permaculture. They are basically waiting for the entire capitalist infrastructure, the whole global economy, and the whole system of nation states to collapse, and they're ready. So, by the way, are the Campus Gaudi people, man, they can make buildings with the tools of the Middle Ages, right? Do you guys know how to build a building with the materials of the Middle Ages, right? So you don't have to go off and, you know, join a eco-village to do that, but there's a way in which you can think about, hey, look, the way that human beings flourish and thrive in all circumstances is by community, by being together, by sharing ideas, by being creative. That's the kind of prefigurative politics that we can do, which we're not doing because we're so focused on the negative stuff on the other side sometimes.
I guess I had two short questions, one of which is that, you know, I work in media, and it's hard because, like, things are objectively terrible, and I think actually sometimes with, like, the political stuff, like, there's this both sides, and it actually sort of diminishes, like, what's actually happening, and it makes it seem like, well, you don't have to like it, but it's smart politics, as Jay Rosen at NYU would put it. And it's sort of, and I think in order to get to sort of a more, you know, a better world, like, there has to be accountability. Like, I think it was Amy Westervelt, or it might have been her podcast partner, Drill, that said the biggest climate solution is a political accountability. Like, the problem with the climate change isn't, like, the solutions part, it's, like, the political will to do so. And I guess I'm just wondering, like, as a reporter, like, how can you sort of tell the truth and be pragmatic, but also not be like, everything is terrible? And my other question was, because you do have to say, like, oh, no, these people are actually, like, you know, fascists. Like, sorry, I hate to break it to you, but well, sorry, you know, or whatever it is. And then, you know, you need to hold them accountable in order to get to a better place. And then the other thing I was curious about was if you had considered it all in your book, or maybe it could be for another book or something, you know, just sort of disability studies and disability justice, because that interdependence is a really big part of it. And I think in utopia, we tend to think disability doesn't exist. And it's sort of like, that's eugenics, honey. So I'm just curious if you engaged that at all, and like, you know, or maybe another book or something. Thank you.
Yeah, Arwa, do you want to talk about the journalism one? I think you're more prepared for that than I am. Yeah, how do you stay hopeful as a journalist?
I do think it is so frustrating as a journalist to not be like, you know, there's so much tiptoeing around certain subjects, so much like racially charged, racially tinged, you know, racially flavored, when, you know, you could just say racist and, you know, and not calling out people. And this sort of, and I will give a plug to The Guardian that I do think they are a little bit better about not both sizing certain things in American politics and actually calling just with that outsider view and calling things what they are rather than kind of, you know, feeling like you have to pretend that these people are actually doing something rational and, you know, not malicious when they are just being malicious. So, and, you know, reporting is so important, like political accountability is so important, and that's why local news is under attack and people are trying to decimate the news. And, you know, now Twitter used to be a place where you could see different opinions, and now Elon Musk is just kind of, you know, decimated Twitter. So it's really difficult. But, you know, I think it's just, again, it's like as each individual has to do the best that they can and call out, you know, call these things out. And I think also, you know, what you're talking about earlier with the hate mobs, as a journalist, you get like, there are concerted campaigns to try and shut down journalists. I'm sure you're aware that if, you know, the right wing will come and attack you, and they'll try to silence you, and they'll try to get you fired, and they have got lots of journalists fired for saying things they don't like. And I think media companies don't know how to deal with these right wing online mobs, and they haven't learned that it is a playbook. You know, they get into this defensive mode, and I think big media companies need to actually sit down and understand, how am I going to respond to these attacks, these coordinated attacks to shut people, mainly young women of color, shut them up, basically. I think the big media organizations still haven't learned how to deal with digital media and how it's being weaponized. And I think that is so important to do if we're going to like combat that both sidesism. So that's my little soapbox. But,
yeah, no, yeah. Absolutely. And then, yeah, just finally, I don't grapple with those questions in this book, but it's definitely something that I think is very important. And, you know, all of these communities are, you know, not all of them are explicitly, let's say, feminist or explicitly progressive. Some of them are actually conservative, but in this weird Bible communist way, right? Because there are a lot of Bible communists out there who own all their property in common and raise their children in common and do sort of these things, but for very scriptural reasons, right? But I do think that there is a way in all of these communities where, especially because almost without exception, they're multi-generational, right? That there is a real ethic of care in the community. Because when you're living with people in this way, right, you see them every day, you interact with them every day. And so there is a much more kind of capacious understanding of ability than there would be in worlds where we're all siloed into our own little single family boxes and we don't really interact with each other as much, especially now with, you know, digital technologies and things like that. So, but it's definitely something that we should be always thinking about, you know, in our understandings of what the world could look like in the future and how we can be as inclusive as possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. I feel like I learned a lot, and I can't wait to... Everyone should go buy the book hot off the press.
Thank you so much for coming on such a nice night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.